surprised me by picking me as FBI director. And this is where Barack Obama surprised me yet again. He was an extraordinary listener, as good as any I've seen in leadership. In various meetings with the president, I watched him work hard to draw as many viewpoints as possible into a conversation, frequently disregarding the hierarchy reflected in seating arrangements, principals at the table, lower-ranked folks in chairs against the wall. I can recall a meeting in the Situation Room about a classified technology topic where President Obama asked some Silicon Valley whiz kid without a tie sitting against the wall what he thought of the discussion the formally dressed leaders of the nation's military and intelligence agencies had just had at the table. The shaggy dude then contradicted several of us. Obama hunted for points of view. Maybe it was a legacy of his life as a professor, cold-calling someone in the back row. This approach often led to chaotic conversations, but it allowed him to hear views that in the Bush administration would have been watered down by rank or by fear of being teased. No guy without a tie would have been in the Bush Situation Room, and if he somehow snuck into a back row seat, he would not be called upon, and if he spoke anyway, he would be mocked for his attire. Obama had the ability to really discuss something, leveling the field to draw out perspectives different from his own. He would turn and face the speaker, giving them long periods without interruption to share their view. And although he was quiet, he was using his face, his posture, and sometimes small sounds to draw the person out. He was carefully tracking what they said, something he would prove by asking questions when they finished. The questions were often drawn from throughout the minutes he had been listening. President Obama was also more than willing to discuss things that people weren't sure he wanted to hear. I learned this firsthand after I made those controversial comments about law enforcement and race. It turns out they caused considerable concern at the White House. When I joined President Obama in the Oval Office after returning from Chicago, I discovered that he had intentionally excluded his senior staff and the Justice Department from the room. It was to be our first one-on-one meeting in the 26 months I had been FBI director. As I walked through the door by the grandfather clock and saw nobody else, I thought maybe I was about to get an ass-chewing. The president sat in his usual seat, the armchair to the right of the fireplace. I sat on the couch just to his left. There was no chewing out. Instead, the president began the meeting by saying, "I asked you to come because I know your head and your heart, and I want to understand what you're seeing and thinking." We then spoke with each other for about an hour, and I used the word "with" intentionally. It was a true conversation with pushing and pulling, pushing and pulling. The president asked a question that invited an open-ended response. "What are you seeing and what's worrying you?" I talked for about 10 minutes, talked about the map and the calendar, more than 40 of the nation's 60 largest cities seeing rises in killings of young black men, all coming at the same time, in a pattern that didn't line up with other crime trends, and mixed geographically with large cities that were not seeing a murder increase. I explained my worry that most of the country could just ignore the problem, because it was black men dying, and only in those neighborhoods. I also noted my concern that the increases were connected to changes in behavior following the viral videos. I said my goal was to call it out, raise the question of whether the police and the communities were pulling back from each other in small ways that added up to something big. I said my hope was that by raising the question, I could help change behaviors if that was what was happening. When I was done, he expressed appreciation for my focus on the issue, then laid out some of the things I had said publicly that struck a discordant note with him. For example, I had used the term "weed and seed" to describe what I thought was needed, pulling out the bad guys and working to grow something healthy in the space created by the arrests. He asked, "Can you see how that might sound to black people? Calling young men in their community weeds?" He spoke of how black people often resented a trade-off that their circumstances forced them to make. They welcomed the security police bring, but resented the conditions that make that police presence necessary in their neighborhoods: poor schools, few jobs, addiction, and broken families. I responded that it hadn't occurred to me that people of color might hear my words that way. I hadn't taken the time to consider how the term "weed and seed," one we had been using in law enforcement for decades, might strike people, especially black people at a challenging time. I was trapped in my own perspective. A black person, who happened to be President of the United States, helped me see through other eyes. We talked about the impact on black communities from the extraordinarily high percentage of black men in the criminal justice system, and how poor a job our country has done to prepare those in prison to return to productive lives. Although I agree that the jailing of so many black men was a tragedy, I also shared how a term he used, mass incarceration, to describe what in his view was a national epidemic of locking up too many people, struck the ears of those of us who had dedicated much of our lives to trying to reduce crime in minority neighborhoods. To my ears, the term mass incarceration conjures an image of World War II Japanese internment camps, where vast numbers of people were herded behind barbed wire. I thought the term was both inaccurate and insulting to a lot of good people in law enforcement who cared deeply about helping people trapped in dangerous neighborhoods. It was inaccurate in the sense that there was nothing mass about the incarceration. Every defendant was charged individually, represented individually by counsel, convicted by a court individually, sentenced individually, reviewed on appeal individually, and incarcerated. That added up to a lot of people in jail, but there was nothing mass about it, I said. And the insulting part, I explained, was the way it cast as illegitimate the efforts by cops, agents, and prosecutors joined by the black community to rescue hard-hit neighborhoods. He responded by urging me to see how black people might experience law enforcement and the courts very differently, and that it was hard to blame them for seeing the jailing of so many black men in numbers wildly greater than their proportion of the population as anything other than mass. When we were done, I was smarter, and I hoped that in some small way I'd helped him see things from a different perspective as well. Our discussion was the total opposite of the Washington Listen. Each of us actually took the time to really understand a different way of looking at something, and with a mind open to being convinced. President Obama would never have considered such a conversation if he did not have enough confidence in himself to show humility. In fact, if I saw any hint of imbalance with President Obama as a leader, it was on the confidence side of the scale, and I would see it in grappling with the hardest problem I encountered in government, encryption. Before I became FBI director, Edward Snowden, a contractor at the National Security Agency, stole a huge trove of classified data about the NSA's activities and then shared a very large amount of that data with the press. One obvious result of this theft was that it dealt a devastating blow to our country's ability to collect intelligence. Another result was that in the year after his disclosures, bad actors across the world began moving their communications to devices and channels that were protected by strong encryption, thwarting government surveillance, including the kind of court-authorized electronic surveillance the FBI did. We watched as terrorist networks we long